Father, this night I thank you for the spirit of a student, the person who is here, willing and ready to learn. They haven't come to see something like a show. They've come instead to learn something and to grow. And Lord, I am so thankful to be a part of this body for that reason. So with pens in hand and Bibles open, minds ready to receive, speak by the power of your Spirit, for your church does this night have ears to hear. In Jesus' name, amen. The true test of a teacher is what's taught, caught. If the lesson is learned, of course, then the lesson will be lived. Education becomes an expression so that if your child, now a teenager, attends a good medical school, out should come a good doctor. If that same teenager attends a good music school, out should come a good musician. And if you attend a good Bible school, out should come a good Christian. No. We'd assume that, but definitely there is a difference. And that difference has to do with the head and the heart. You see, certainly with the head you can acquire knowledge, but we're not degreeing students as much as we're discipling servants. It has to happen in the heart. For if it happens in the heart, then if there is an obstacle, it's simply an opportunity to grow. If it's only in the head, well, obstacles become, well, they become for you obstructions, and you just simply quit or change your major. You decide it's too tough and you don't want to continue on. Christianity? When it does happen in the heart, you find your students are all successful. Consider Christ. 12 disciples, only one really failed. And out of the remaining 11, 10 volunteered their life. Their life. They actually laid down their life for the cause of Christ. Why? It's what their teacher taught. Remember? It's John's Gospel, the 15th chapter, the 13th verse. Jesus said, "Greater love hath no one than this, than he laid down his life for his friends." So they saw their teacher lay down his life for them. They, therefore, were also willing to lay down their life for him. You see, they were truly, truly disciples. For the love and the loyalty to their leader, the trust and the toil to the teacher. Well, it was the fate of the followers. Consider it with me. We have two Jameses, James the brother of Jesus and James the son of Zebedee. Both, well, they're both killed by an angry mob. We have Philip, who was hung in Phygira. We have Matthew, who was killed by a sword in Ethiopia. We have Bartholomew, who was shot. Andrew. Peter and Peter Simon, or Simon Peter, all three crucified. Thomas and Thaddeus. All but John. All but John. And why slow my pace for their names? Because it's the same thing that happened as I began to, with the newspaper this morning, read the names of those who have lost their lives, called to a cause, defending our freedom. If you really, really, really believe, if you really, really, really have faith, then your expression of that faith, as you've heard me say, is a non-negotiable. It's not whether it's comfortable or whether it's convenient. No, instead, are you courageous? Is there conviction? And if there is, well, you learn. And you learn, and you learn, and you learn. What lessons do you learn? Well, the lessons we have here. It's John chapter 15. I have four lessons. The first of which, we read John 6:15. Therefore, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he departed again to the mountain by himself alone. Here's the way I've written the lesson. Again, I've got four if you're taking note. Jot it down this way. Jesus taught his disciples that crowds don't impress him and flattery doesn't affect him. Listen to that again. Crowds don't impress him and flattery doesn't affect him. Why would that be important? Because certainly they would see, as we see from time to time, crowds that are clamoring for, well, for a man, for a ministry. Pastor Bob, how can you employ this truth being at Calvary Chapel, Fort Lauderdale? Well, because I'm not impressed by the crowd. And flattery, I pray it doesn't affect me. The crowd. What are we called to accomplish? Are we called to create a crowd, or are we instead called to compel converts? You've heard me to say, in the past, a big church? Well, it's only relative to what you think is big. But big? Big for the people in this world? Big for the people who have this thing with size? I mean, think about it. Too often in life, we see size as a sign of success. If you are a woman and your boyfriend, husband-to-be, gives you an engagement ring and there's this really, really, really big rock on it, you show it off. Look at the size of my rock. And everyone's supposed to look on and believe that that's a sign of his sincerity. When in reality, it could be a sign of his stupidity. How's that? My question is, can he afford it? If he drowns his new bride in a sea of debt, that wasn't smart. That was stupid. But because we pay so much attention to size, look at how big my ring is, that's supposed to say something. Can you afford it, is the question I might ask. In the same way, we look on at physical strength, and if a guy's got really big, bulging biceps, big biceps, wow, he must be strong. Is he really strong? Or does he have a lot of time on his hand? How's that? I know personally, trying to have big biceps, it takes a long, long time. I gave up that race. Why? I have a job. Now, please, don't misunderstand, especially you men with big biceps. I love you. As a brother. But what I'm trying to say, I believe Jesus said so much better. Jot it down, Luke 16:50. What's highly esteemed among men is an abomination before God. And again, what is highly esteemed before men is an abomination before God. And it is an abomination in the context of that chapter in Luke 16 and verse 15 when we're thinking one thing that God's not thinking. What's God not thinking that we might be thinking? What God might be thinking that we might be thinking is that we are a success just because of our size. No, I know better than that. Why do I feel that that's not an indication that God's hand is upon this body? Here's what I know. I know on the one hand, ministry must be the fruit of our effectiveness. If this is a social scene for you, although this might be a large church, I'm failing miserably. I also know that sometimes we have a tendency to look on its size and say we're successful, when in reality, if we got a glimpse in His glory, we might be failing miserably and that He wants us much larger. I mean, the comment that comes oftentimes is, well, what do you think about a large church? And I'll oftentimes respond and say, what do you think about a large department store? What do you think about a large hardware store? You see, we're living in a time and age where, yes, we have 300,000 square feet of space, but so does Lowe's, so does Home Depot, so does Walmart. Walmart's got a supersized store that makes ours look small. So in a day and age where the dime store is large and the hardware store is large, is the church continuing to stay at 73 people on an average per congregation across the United States of America? And if in fact the hardware store is that size, and if in fact the Walmart store is that size, is the church allowed to be that size if in fact it's doing ministry effectively? Why is that important? There's a crowd clamoring for Christ. And certainly the disciples can look on and say, hey, this is incredible. Jesus, you're a hit. This is incredible. Can you believe how many people are following you? Here's what we're thinking. Because they all want to follow you after this bread thing. If you can do the bread thing every week for like a month, Here's what we're thinking. Yes, we'll get everybody together. You feed them bread. In fact, we can kind of stage it. Every week we'll have a little boy come up and he'll have loaves and fishes. And we'll go, hey, you only got loaves and fishes. How will we do this, Master? And then you test one of us. And last week was Philip's turn. We can take a turn every week with some of the other disciples. Well, can I look dumbfounded? Like, how are we going to do this? And then you just lift it up, just like you did in the first part of John chapter 6. You lift it up, you break it, and we bless it. And then it becomes, wow, let's do this every week, Lord, just like we did it. Lord, aren't you listening to us? We're not just ministers, we're also marketeers. And we're thinking, Lord, where did Jesus go? Where did he just go? Doesn't he want to become popular? And doesn't he want to become powerful? And doesn't he want to overthrow Rome? Lord, we're telling you, do the bread thing every week. It'll be great for the ministry. You're a hit. Where did he go? He went back to the same place he always goes, up in the hills alone with his father. Don't you know that by now? Yeah, but doesn't he know it wasn't just a crowd here, but there was a crowd that was trying to make him king? Doesn't he know they're trying to make him king? Trying to make him king. Is that his purpose right now, to become king? No. Now listen. The Bible teaches that we are earthen vessels. We're earthen vessels. And that the treasure in us is from God. Now, if we are earthen vessels and the treasure that's in us is from God, and the reason that we carry this treasure in earthen vessels is that He wants us to always stay earthen, simple, transparent, vulnerable, so that the surpassing power and greatness can be of God and not of us. The problem is sometimes we don't like being earthen vessels. Oh, we start out in ministry in earthen vessels. Yeah, I'm a guy just like everybody else. And then the building begins to grow and the budget begins to increase and I don't see myself anymore as an earthen vessel. No. I'm a ceramic pot. I don't like the word pot. Call me a vase. No. I don't even like ceramic. I like a porcelain vase. I'm a porcelain vase. Now don't touch me. I'm not an earthen vessel anymore. What happened to that clay pot? Looks like he's cracked. Looks like he's a crack pot. That was horrible. I apologize to you. But the point is still clear. You want to glorify God? Stay an earthen vessel. I go back to that plaque that's in my office. Always a student, never a scholar. The more I know, the more I realize I don't know. And the more that I think I can do it on my own, the more He places on my path something I can't do at all, but it be for Him providing the strength. That's when He's glorified. That's when He's honored. And these guys, at this point, I don't know that they get it, but this would be very, very important to them. You see, the lesson that the disciples are learning right now is don't be impressed by the crowds and don't find that flattery affects you. Why? Well, because if somebody says, we want you to be king, you want me to be king? No. There's only one king. That's King Jesus. And even now he says, no, now's not the time. You guys don't get it. I got to get alone with my father. And in spending time with my father, I'll have perspective. Why? Listen to this. If I hang around with people who want to flatter me and hang around a congregation that's large and enjoy the press, if I stay there too long and stay away from God, I'm not reminded in my intimacy with God that I'm an undone, incomplete man living in sinful flesh, and that apart from Him, I can do nothing. You see, when I get close to God, I'll usually start like most of us start, Lord, here I am, and here's what I'm thinking, and here's what I've got planned, and wow, are you ever holy? And when I read His Word, I find, man, am I not everything I ought to be? And as I read His Word, the more I realize, man, you know what? There's a lot of areas in your life that you're even kind of faking it on. And, you know, you need to become a little bit more real with who God is. And you ever find that the more time you spend with Him, the more undone you feel, so that when you came into your prayer closet,
ready to move a mountain, ready to speak to the...
Stop it. What are you doing? It's me, Lord. I know. So don't do this. Talk to me. And now be honest. Well, Lord, here's where I struggled last week, and here's where I really want to change, and here's what I'm really hoping to accomplish, and I believe you're with me on this. Okay. Why is that necessary? Because a prideful person, he resists, and a humble person, he gives grace to. And I think it's an important lesson his disciples will need to learn. Why? He's going to go. He's going to be gone. Spirit's going to be here. But a powerful thing's going to happen when Peter preaches in just a short period of time. He's going to, with his mouth, preach such a powerful message. In one day, 3,000 people will be added to the church. In one day. Now again, relative to the size of a ministry, this now in one day, some scholars suggest that the church at that time was easily on its way to, well, at the close of the book of Acts, we have several tens of thousands of followers, true believers in Jesus Christ. And it's something that they're having a hard time containing, the first church is. So size? Well, we don't want to pat ourselves on the back if God wants it bigger. But at the same time, we don't want to puff ourselves up if, in fact, it's a work of the flesh. So please, no. The lesson that's learned is, you know, please, crowds don't impress him, and flattery doesn't affect him. And if we will see the value of spending time with the core rather than this crowd, then we will know how Jesus balanced his ministry. Yes, there's a time to spend opportunity with the core rather than this crowd. This crowd? Yes, Jesus would be, but this crowd, look at the great crowd. And Jesus would say, now I've got to spend time alone with my Father so I can get back to my core, the disciples, and continue to invest in them so I can make a difference in their lives. Difference in their lives? Let's see what happens with that difference. Verse 16, chapter 6. Now, when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and went over toward the sea, or sea toward Capernaum, and it was already dark, and Jesus had come to them. Then the sea arose because a great wind was blowing. So when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near the boat. They were afraid. And he said to them, "It is I. Do not be afraid." And watch verse 21. And they willingly received him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land where they were going. If you're taking note, second lesson disciples learn, stormy seas are the perfect place to welcome Christ in. Stormy seas are the perfect place to welcome Christ in? Exactly. You see, a prideful heart has no place for Christ. And I have seen again and again in ministry where some people say, I can do this on my own. You know, you really don't need Jesus in every aspect of your life. This is a decision that I'm qualified to make. And sometimes we rely upon our education. Sometimes we rely upon our experience. And with our education, our experience, we say, you know what, Lord, you're really good on Sunday mornings to help me feel like I'm one with you and I've got a place in the kingdom. But it's Monday morning. I've got a task list to go over and to accomplish and not necessary for you right now. Man, if that's not pride. If it's not, I can do this on my own. It's, I can't do this on my own, but I don't want to be a hypocrite. And I know a lot of people like that. Where the seas of life begin to rage wild, and you say to them, well, you know you ought to pray. Oh, I'm not going to pray now. Why won't you pray now? Well, because I just don't want to be a hypocrite. I know myself well enough. I'm going to pray, and then God will get me out of this jam, and I'm going to go right back to the same old style of living that I've always had, so I don't want to be a hypocrite. So you don't want to be a hypocrite, you just want to be a fool? Is that what you'd rather do? Well, what do you mean? Well, think about it. And jot this down. Proverbs 11:2. When pride comes, then comes disgrace. But with humility comes wisdom. Now I want you to chew on that just for a moment. Listen to it again. When pride comes, then comes disgrace. But with humility comes wisdom. You see, if you say to yourself, hey, I can do this on my own. Do what on your own that you would not enhance or make better if God was involved? I mean, I can't actually think of anything in my day that I could improve on my own, but that I couldn't actually really improve with His help. And it's an amazing thing to consider how God does want to be involved in every little and big decision of your life. Someone asked, You think Jesus is so interested in your life that he wants to be involved in all the little things? I've learned that when you put him in a proper place on the little things, the big things many times are not that big. Because all the little things end up becoming decisions he assists you with, and now the big things, not a lot of things are big, because he's just involved in all of your life. I also tend to think that sadly we miss the opportunity to get God involved in some of the little things in life, thinking he doesn't care, he's not interested. In reality, those little decisions affect our bigger decisions in a much bigger way. I want God to be concerned with my diet, because I know that what I put into this temple affects my outlook in life. I want God making decisions about my apparel. I want God making decisions about what I drive and what house I live in. I want God making all of these decisions. I want God helping with my devotions when I try and teach the kids and when my wife is making a decision about something that affects the house. I want him involved in everything. And when you say you don't, think of the foolishness attached to that attitude. I really don't need God's wisdom, don't need God's strength, don't need God's peace, don't need God's perspective. I have found much wiser. Make him a part of everything. Get him involved in everything. He wants to be involved in everything. How's that? Remember, and again, I emphasize this point, and I have some more so once I became a dad, but because he's a dad, he wants to be involved in everything. Your mother wants to make every decision in your life, doesn't she? She does. And all you go, yeah, my mom really would like to lead my whole life. Well, you've got a father. His name is God. He wants to lead your life, and it's for all the right reasons. He cares about you, and he knows what's happening beyond. He knows what's happening in the future. He knows how those decisions that you don't let him be a part of are only going to be the opportunity to prove to yourself that as pride leads you to making your own decisions, how disgrace will come, because he loves you enough. He's not going to let you get away with it. I mean, one of the worst things he can do is let you make a decision all on your own and let it be successful, because when it is successful, you assume that you can do these things without him. And you keep on marching along the way, and with your experience and your education, you say, I can do all these things on my own. Then suddenly, what is it? Bankruptcy? Moral failure? Something so serious? You look back at the past and say, what in the world happened? We continue to exclude him from your daily decisions, and you continue to push him away. And finally, what happened is you felt the pain of the disgrace that comes from lack of humility, because with pride, there will certainly soon be a fall. So here's my questions for you on this same section. Did he send out his disciples not knowing about the storm? No, he knew about the storm. Well, did he send them because of the storm? And in other words, did he send them and say, you know what, here's the deal, guys. You learned in the first half of the chapter about how I can manifest bread out of a children's bag lunch. So I'm wondering, you know what, for me to do the food thing again, you'd get it. Here's what I'll do instead. I showed up when you were in a pinch when it came to needing food. I'll show up when you're in a pinch and you're in the seas and storms. So let's find out if anything stuck from the last lesson that I am God, and we'll put you on a boat, we'll send you out to the sea and see how you respond. Now, here's my question. Third, same section. Did he disguise his body but only reveal his voice? Look at it again. Verse 19. So when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near to the boat, they were afraid. They didn't recognize him. I'm convinced of it. Another gospel record tells us they thought it was a ghost. Now, if they think he's a ghost, they go, wait a second, we can't let him in the boat. Jesus says, hey, it's me. And now they can't discern that it's him physically, but they can hear him audibly, and he's teaching his disciples how important it is to hear his voice. You got to hear my voice. Don't be looking for the physical. Why? It's more important that you learn not to look with your eyes and to listen with your ears. Why? Because the Spirit is always speaking to the church. And when the Spirit speaks to the church, you have to have ears to hear. But visually, you may find in life that God uses somebody visibly that you wouldn't normally pay attention to. Visibly. But still audibly, as his still small voice speaks, he could still be speaking to you and saying, hey, it's me, don't be afraid. So here they are in the boat. Hey guys, it's me. Now, how could have they responded? They could have said, we don't believe you. Stay out of the boat. It's a ghost. I'm sure it is. Stay away. Stay away. We'll get fine. We're fine. We don't need any help. They could have done that. I know me. And I always try and put myself in the shoes of one of the disciples, or the sandals in one of the disciples. And I stand there in a boat and say, okay, seas are rough. You're already having a bad night. It's dark. Rough seas. Here comes a ghost. I don't want him on board. I'm not going to add to my complications inviting a ghost on board. I'll just pretend like he doesn't exist. I don't hear you. I don't hear you. I don't hear you. Keep on rowing, guys. And it's an amazing thing, because if you go to Israel with us sometime, you'll see that the Sea of Galilee, as they go to Capernaum, there's this big space. And when it's dark at night, it's not like there are streetlights on all the hills. There are some places where you can look a distance of 10, 15, 20 miles, and you can't tell the sea from the land, from the sky. I mean, it is just dark, like dark, like dark. So here you are in a boat. You can't see a thing. You thought Jesus was going to join you in the boat trip. He told you to hop in the boat and go, and you kept on waiting for him. And the way the Bible puts it is he never showed up. So you're thinking, you're a hit. If you could do the bread thing every week, evidently you're not interested in that. You're going to go pray to your father. Guys, how long should we wait for Jesus? Well, let's just go ahead and hop in the boat. Maybe he's had another plan. We get in the boat. We've gone 3-4 miles. Now, how long do you think it takes to row 3 or 4 miles in stormy seas? We're rowing, and we're rowing, and we're rowing. And now our arm muscles, we're building.